Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This is the program that where once a month we talk about home maintenance. And our guest is Hank Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. He's been doing this with us for a long time, stopping by on a regular basis to answer your questions. If you have a problem, something needs to be fixed, you're thinking about making some changes, doing some remodeling, whether we're talking about basements or attics, siding or roofing, windows or doors, gutters or whatever, if you have those kinds of questions, inside, outside, I know he'll do his best to help you out. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 is the number to call. And we also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Welcome back.
It's always good to be back.
We have some people getting ready ready to go. So, in fact, we had somebody even during the newscast who was waiting patiently, so we'll get right to them in Champaign on line number one.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I'd like to thank you for your advice on our installing our new furnace, and now we want to insulate the crawl space, and it's kind of a hodgepodge of construction styles under there, anywhere from enclosed pilings, as far as I can tell, to one layer of exposed brickwork on towards the outside. Now, what I remember from watching a This Old House episode, at one time they showed the installation of a spray-on foam insulation, where it's sprayed on in a thin layer, then promptly expanded into a foam and cured. But that was a large, commercially applied product. Is there anything like that for use at the consumer level, like maybe out of an aerosol can?
No, there are a number of local firms, or at least two that I know of, who will do it in the Champaign-Urbana area. However, probably the easiest thing to do is to go down and buy yourself some 2-inch expanded polystyrene foam insulation board and just glue it to the foundation. And then in the band joist area, that portion from the top of the foundation up to the bottom of the floor, cut some pieces of fiberglass bat and just stuff them in up there. And that usually does the job. Now you want to be sure that your crawl space is dry and stays dry.
We have the plastic sheeting on it.
Right.
The thing was, it's not a very large area, maybe 10 or 15 square feet of your regularly exposed brickwork, and so it might require some cutting and piecing together of foam. That's what we were worried about. And doesn't one need to wear a respirator and so on, protective equipment for handling fiberglass?
No, not particularly. What we usually do is you buy the fiberglass bats and take a large paper cutter or something like this, and chop them into 8 or 10 inch long pieces, and they stuff right in. If you feel more comfortable wearing a little dust mask over your nose, that's fine. But so far, no one has come up with the fact that fiberglass causes problems. A lot of people have tried, namely the manufacturers of competing varieties of insulation.
Okay.
But so far, no research has indicated that it's a problem.
All right. Should we buy the fiberglass with the vapor barrier?
Absolutely.
I always have trouble remembering which way that goes.
It goes on the warm side, which would, in this case would be toward the crawl space.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right. On to another caller. This is also Champaign and line number two.
Hello. Hi.
Yeah.
I was wondering about fixing old windows, and we just had a guy looking at our house, and he was showing us the little knockout parts to fix the weights in the windows.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering how to best remove those and replace those without causing more damage than I have to.
Okay. There is an excellent step-by-step article on how to do this in the Old House Journal. And I believe it is the April 2000 issue, which you can get from libraries. I'm working off the top of my head now, but if that isn't right, give me a call at my office, and I can get you a copy of it.
All right.
But
okay, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Is there anything else you wanted to say about that? How complicated is it replacing the old sash weights on old windows?
The first one is very complicated. Once you figured out what you're doing, it's not bad.
Okay. Okay. If you know, it's not hard if you know what you're doing, is what you say.
Right. And usually there's some paint stripping involved. And the one thing that you do have to be careful of is that you are probably stripping some old lead-based paint.
Ah, uh-huh. Okay.
So that you have to go on the basis that the paint you're removing probably is lead-based if you have something old enough to still have the old weights.
All right. I hope that helps. So let's go to another Champagne person. This is line three. Hello.
Hi, Hank Spies. We have a 25 to 30 year old home that has a very cold second floor, and I think it has minimal insulation in the attic. It also doesn't have a floor in the attic. Would bats be a much better thing to install? Because in case there's any, you know, work to ever be done in the future, if you put in the blown, you wouldn't have any idea where you could stand.
Well, that would be the only advantage of bats. Generally speaking, the blown-in insulation will do a better job because it fits. It blows into all the nooks and crannies, and you don't end up any holidays in the insulation. And it will usually be considerably less expensive. And as a matter of fact, in many cases, you can have insulation blown in cheaper than you can buy the bats and put them in yourself. So I would probably go in with the blown. And remember that we really are not designing the structure to hold much of any weight in there anyway.
Well, it was just that we have exhaust fans, you know, that vent through the roof. And at one point they were, you know, up there working on those. And I thought if we had blown in, we might never be able to enter the attic again.
Well, you just have to lay a plank across so you can get to them.
Mm-hmm. So you recommend the blown in?
Yes, I would.
And so any of the companies listed in the Yellow Pages would be okay for that?
Yes, most of them. Some of them are considerably less expensive than others.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, if you want to give me a call at my office, I can throw one or two at you. And
what is the phone number at your office?
356-5048.
5048. And is there a particular R value? I mean, I know with bats you work for a particular R value.
Generally speaking, we're looking, the current standard for attics is about R38 to 40,
mm-hmm.
which is usually about 8 to 10 inches of insulation.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sure would be nice to have a warmer house.
Yes. And part of it, you may be able to rebalance your heating system a little bit, too, so that it brings more air up there. Generally speaking, do you have central air?
Yes.
Okay. Most of our systems are designed for heating, but there should be some dampers so that you can adjust what goes where. In other words, in the summertime, we want to bring cool air upstairs because cool air falls. In the wintertime, we want to put in most of the warm air on the first floor because heat rises. So we need to make this adjustment spring and fall as to where the system is delivering the air. And again, you can have problems where we, in the wintertime, generally speaking, a northwest room needs more heat than a southeast room because most of our cold winds come from the northwest. In the summertime, south and southwest rooms are picking up most of the solar gain. So we have to be able to balance the heating system to our house, and you can do it once for winter and once for summer, and then just take a magic marker and mark the positions of the various settings on the outlets and duct dampers and so on, and then just go back the next year and move back to the appropriate seasonal position.
Hadn't thought of that. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Our guest here this morning in this first hour of Focus 580, Hank Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. He is on the program every month. It's always a Monday. We talk about home maintenance issues. And if you have questions, you can call us 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We have a question here from someone who wanted to hear this answer and apparently is able to listen but knew they wouldn't be able to call. So I wanted to get that in, and then we'll get some more callers from people who are calling in. And the listener wants to know, when you're having an asbestos roof removed, do the people living in the house need to be concerned about inhaling dangerous particles? And is there anything that you would suggest they do in terms of safety precautions if they're going to be there while the work is being done?
Well, in general, probably stay indoors. Generally speaking, the cement asbestos shingles that would be removed are not dangerous unless you grind them finely and then snort it, which I suspect you're not likely to do. However, in taking them off, they will break, and when they break, asbestos particles are ejected into the air. In other words, I would suggest staying in the house. The people who are doing the work probably ought to have some type of mask, but that's up to them. But the chrysotile asbestos, which is, there's one of three varieties of minerals called asbestos. The chrysotile is what was used in the residential work, the siding, the shingles, and actually on most of the furnaces. That has never been proven to be a carcinogen. The other two varieties of asbestos have, but we almost never run into those in single-family residences. They were used primarily to insulate structural steel in high-rise buildings and insulation aboard ships. And this is where most of the problems with inhaled asbestos have come from. So the asbestos you have in your residential structure is highly unlikely to be a significant danger. And as I say, we want to avoid inhaling the stuff. And if when they're taking it off on the outside, you stay on the inside, you're in pretty good shape.
Okay. We now have a number of callers. In fact, the lines are full, so we'll get right back to talking with folks here. Starting with Urbana, line one.
Me?
Yes.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question about the garage remote door opener. The old house is an old house. It is 2 years that doesn't work. We picked one from Sears and one from Maynard, but none of them works. My question is, do we need to change all the system of that?
You're referring to the electric door openers?
Uh-huh.
No, I wouldn't think so. I don't think I've ever seen an overhead-type door that the door openers wouldn't handle. Horizontal sliding doors, yes, but not overheads. So there are several companies in town who specialize in installing and repairing them. You'll find them in the Yellow Pages. And I would say that any one of those, one of the ones that regularly support this program is Champaign-Urbana Overhead Door.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that they probably could take care of the problem.
Thanks a lot.
All right. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Line number two, I think, would be next, and the caller is in Muhammad. Hello.
Hello, I have a question. A number of my neighbors have had their houses tested for radon and installed radon abatement systems. What is the danger of radon, and at what threshold of radon would you recommend a radon abatement system, and do you have any recommended vendors or contractors in the area? My basement is like half crawl space and half... basin. And I'll
okay.
Hang up and listen to your answer.
Well, basically it depends on whose criteria you want to believe. The Environmental Protection Agency has plucked out of midair the number of 4 picocuries per liter as being their, quote, level of concern, unquote. There is significant evidence to suggest that this was picked so there would be enough houses in violation to justify their budget. There is a growing body of information that anything under 20 really presents very little problem. And there are a few houses in Mahomet that are that high. Mahomet readings are generally higher than they are in Champaign. But you want to test the lowest regularly inhabited room. We do not test the crawl space. We test the basement only if you have your office down there or something or other. Going down to check the furnace and so on doesn't constitute regularly inhabited, so you want to check the lowest regularly inhabited room. Then remember that the radon mitigation contractors are licensed by the state. They have to meet certain standards, and you can get some bids. There's usually several ways that you may attack a specific radon problem, and it all depends on how that particular contractor works. In some cases, they will put in a perforated tube under the plastic in the crawl space, hook an exhaust fan to that. They will probably seal, if you have a sump pump, they will probably seal the top of the sump and hook an exhaust fan to the top of the sump, because your sump has tiles going from around the house into it, and we want to pick up any radon that may end up in those tiles and so on. And then this fan runs 24/7. So this is basically how it is done. Whether you need to do it or not, as I say, depends upon what you believe are the hazards involved. Personally, I think the level of 4 is much lower than I would consider to be a level of concern. As I say, basically, I look at anything under 20 is probably not a problem. This standard varies around the world. In Norway, I think it's 2. In Canada, it is 20, as to what the level of concern is. And there is no scientific agreement as to what that level should be. So you have to look at it from that standpoint. But any radon mitigation system will undoubtedly involve some way of picking up any gases that come out of the soil and blowing them outside, preferably through the roof so they are dispersed elsewhere. And as I say, this is a licensed and regulated business of providing radon mitigation, and it all depends on how that particular contractor is working it.
How much variability can there be in I guess the question, a better way to ask the question is, if you have someone who lives next door to you, and if they have determined that they have a problem,
it may have no relation to your problem.
So that's the question. You could live next door to them, and they could have radon,
is absolutely correct. We also have to be careful as to when we measure it. When we have a low-pressure system, the radon level is high. If we're measuring it during a high-pressure system for weather, it will be lower than normal. Mm-hmm. So the only thing that really counts is a long-term test where we can put in something for a week or more, maybe even as much as a month, to determine the level rather than on any specific time.
Mm-hmm. And they're still available, we've talked about this before in the program, a kind of a tester that you will hang up, you would leave for a period of time, and then you send it off to somebody, and then they check it, and they send you back the number that says, okay, this is what we got.
That's correct. That is correct. As I say, we're fortunate in Champaign-Urbana, our background levels are relatively low. Both Mahomet and Danville are higher.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, we are talking this morning with Hank Spies. He's here on the program once a month to talk about home maintenance. If you have questions, call us, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. The next person in line is Urbana, and that's line 3. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. We have an 80-year-old house. We need to replace the front exterior door. And I noticed that there are steel doors, fiberglass doors, and wooden doors. And I just wanted to hear a little bit about some of the advantages and disadvantages. I mean, do I automatically assume that paying more for a fiberglass door is the best thing I can do?
No, not necessarily. It much depends upon the appearance that you are looking at. For instance, a fiberglass door is available in a finish that looks like wood and can be stained like wood. So if you want a wood-appearing door, you go probably with the fiberglass. If you don't mind the texture or lack thereof that the steel doors have, you can go with the steel doors. One of the things that you need to remember is that the steel doors are probably, steel and fiberglass both, are pretty well insulated. They may be as well insulated as your walls as far as our value is concerned. This means that if you put a glass storm door on them, you have just built a solar collector. And we particularly find this a problem in steel doors. where the space between them, the storm door and the interior door, is hot enough that any plastic molding used for trim on the door will expand and break or deflect. They also can get very hot. I have measured in March, when outdoor temperature was around 30 degrees, a surface temperature of 180 on a steel door that had a full glass storm door over it. This is enough to fry a small child to the door.
Oh, boy. So would you say that if our reason for putting a storm door was for insulating purposes, then it's sort of ill-advised?
If it faces the sun, if it's particularly a south-facing door, yes.
Okay.
And it's also ill-advised to make it a dark-colored door.
Okay.
Because the dark door absorbs a lot more heat than the light-colored door does.
Okay, and that'll be the same for steel or fiberglass.
That's correct. Now, as I say, I've not run into the surface temperature problem as much with fiberglass as I have with the steel.
Okay.
There's still nothing wrong with wood.
Right.
If you want a wood finish, you probably will end up having to re-varnish the thing every couple of years, because nothing that we have withstands the sun that well.
Okay. Great. Well, thanks a lot.
All right. Thank you. Well, just to add, not to put too fine a point on this, but if you've got a door that is insulated, is there really any point to having a glass storm door on the outside?
From an insulation standpoint, no. Now, if you want to put a screen in that door for ventilation in the summertime, fine. I just never put the glass down.
So you just would say you can leave the screen in there year round.
Right.
All right.
Because, generally speaking, the steel doors have either a magnetic or very good compression weather strip, so you have a good tight seal there.
Yeah.
And generally speaking, you don't really need it to have the storm door on.
All right. Next caller is in Urbana, and that would be line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi. We're selling our house, and some potential buyers got up in the attic, and we're poking around in the insulation. And we're questioning whether it has asbestos in it or not. And I looked at it under a microscope, and it basically looks like blown-in paper fibers or wood fibers. And I was sort of wondering what the prevalence of asbestos in Urbana is. Is it something to worry about? Should I have a test?
How old is the house?
Oh, gosh, 60, 70 years.
It's highly unlikely that there is any asbestos there.
Okay.
Generally speaking, what was put in was rock wool or cellulose in one form or another, and neither one of those is a problem.
Okay, I understand that mainly the asbestos insulation was a vermiculite type?
That's right. There was some asbestos in the vermiculite, and that's pretty readily recognizable.
Okay, but that's basically where that asbestos insulation is?
Yes. Now, I won't say there wasn't some used probably even longer ago than you're talking about.
Uh-huh.
But again, unless you are up there creating dust, it shouldn't really be a problem.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you.
All right. Thank you. And let's see. Next, we will talk with someone in Lafayette, line number two, right here. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I have a short path in the backyard of flagstones, only half a dozen of them. But they're developing some pretty bad and slippery green moss. I don't have a power washer, and it's too small a project anyway for that. Can I just use diluted bleach on the limestone?
Yes, that wouldn't hurt anything. Or for that matter, plain old lawn spray 2,4-D will probably kill off green moss.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly there's nothing wrong with using bleach on it. It's not going to attack the flagstone to any great extent.
Limestone.
Right.
Okay, thanks.
Mm-hmm. All right. To line number four in Paris. Hello.
Hello, that's me, right?
Yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. First of all, I want to thank Mr. Spies for his treatise on front doors. That was very educational for me. Now, I am not very knowledgeable about things, and this is my first hot water heater that I'm going to have to buy on my own. If you have two people in the house, how large a hot water heater should one expect to buy?
Well, I wouldn't put in anything smaller than a 40-gallon. Is this gas or electric?
What was it, 40?
Is this going to be a gas or an electric?
A gas.
Okay. I would probably go with a 40.
40-gallon. 40-gallon. Okay. And is there anything special I should ask them to do when they're putting in this? We do have one down there now that will be replaced, I suppose. Is there anything they have to do about insulation or anything that maybe hasn't been done in the past?
The new water heaters are really quite well insulated, and you should be putting on a new pressure temperature relief valve, or so-called safety valve.
Let me write that down. Pressure temperature what?
Relief valve.
Relief?
Right.
Oh, valve, okay.
Now, the pipe coming off of that valve should go down to within 3 inches of the floor.
3 inches of the floor.
Right. This is because if that valve ever opens, there will be some very hot water and maybe even steam coming out of there.
Oh, yeah.
And we want to get it down out of the way so you don't get scalded trying to turn the thing off.
That's right. I probably wouldn't be able to turn it off anyway. I wouldn't know where. I should find out, shouldn't I?
Yes. They should show you where the gas valve is so that you can turn it off.
I have a lot to learn.
And the other thing is, I presume is your house old enough that it has galvanized pipe instead of copper pipe?
I think we have some copper pipe because it's 44 years old, but this man that built it for himself, and he thought copper pipe was good.
Okay, he was right. And I won't go into the problem of connecting one to the other.
They don't like the idea of copper pipes. Some of them say it's not in their resume to do copper pipe. That's what one person once told me. I was shocked.
You don't want him on the job.
okay. Okay, so turn it off. Find out where the turnoff is for the, okay. 3 inches from the floor and a release valve.
Yeah.
Okay. Is there anything I should do to care for this thing? I think it just kind of cares for itself. It always has in the past.
Pretty much so. It all depends on your water quality.
We have softer water, I believe, than you do. We have lake water, you know, we call it a lake.
Right.
And but we're going to groundwater, perhaps. When you go to groundwater, then it probably...
If you put in a water softener, then that pretty well takes care of it.
I don't like water softeners.
Well...
You think I should? No?
Well, not necessarily.
I'm going to try to avoid that.
It depends. Now, you see, in Champaign-Urbana, we have a municipal softening system.
Oh, I believe they do here, too. I believe you're right. Yes, I believe they do.
So we don't worry about that. Okay. There are those people who strongly believe that you should... open the valve at the bottom of the water heater and run out a few gallons of water once a year. I don't know that unless you have really bad water, I'm not sure that helps a heck of a lot.
Oh, okay. So don't worry about that. I never have. We've never done that.
Right.
So,
and your water heater...
Actually, our water heaters do last quite a long time.
What, 20 years or so?
I think so, yes.
Yeah.
And it's not gone out yet.
Right.
I'm just preparing for the future.
Well, you see...
It's not heating up as much as it used to, so I have a feeling there's some stuff in there.
When the burner is on, you hear it thumping a little bit, sort of like a percolator. That indicates that we've got crud accumulated in the bottom.
I haven't heard that.
Okay.
So bumping. Listen for bumping.
Right.
And if I hear bumping, then what do I do?
Well, probably it's time to replace the water heater, but you can try opening that valve at the bottom and see whether you can flush some of the crud out of it.
Yeah, maybe just, it is old, so maybe getting a new one would be
thing. That's probably true because the new
Are they more efficient now than they used to be?
Yes, they are.
Okay, that's good. That's already a good thing. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, you have helped me tremendously. I will write all this up and save it for the moment.
All right.
Thank you so much, Mr.
Sure Steve. Thing. Thanks for the call. Just to make sure people understand about this valve business, on a water heater, there are two valves. There's one that's down at the bottom near the floor. That's what you would use if you were going to drain it.
That's right. Out. That's the drain.
The other one you were talking about is going to be up near the top of the tank.
That's correct, and it will usually have a little lever on the top of it. If you pull this little lever, you should get water squirting out of it wherever it discharges. Generally speaking, you should try that lever about once a year to make sure that the valve is not stuck. Mm-hmm. However, you never do that when the hardware store is closed. In case it doesn't reseal properly.
Right. And this here, that's where you want it. It needs to have a pipe that's going to go from there all the way down to
all the way down
the floor.
So that in, if this thing ever opens, it will be because the whole, something, the gas valve is stuck open or something or other, and we are literally boiling the water in that tank. Mm-hmm. And in order to get to it to shut it off without getting scalded, we not want to pipe it down out of the way. And it is very desirable to check that valve once a year. And as I say, you never do it when the hardware store is closed, because it may not reseat if it hasn't been checked recently. Because that safety valve is the third and last item in line as far as the safety is concerned. So that if this thing were to stay on and heat and heat and heat until everything boiled, if the tank ever explodes, it is equal to about a half a case dynamite.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, we want to be darn sure it doesn't.
Uh-huh.
I mean, the last one of these things I had data on was in a strip mall in Washington State. The water heater went out through the roof across a six-lane highway, 500 feet out into a parking lot, did $500,000 damage and put poor people in the hospital.
I see.
Remember, we are working with steam. We used to run locomotives with steam.
So the easy thing is just to make sure that this...
Make darn sure that valve works.
That valve works. All right. Very good. We have one other caller on hold, and certainly plenty of time for others. Hank Spies is our guest from the Spies Home Inspection Service. He is with us each month. On a Monday, we talk about home maintenance. And whatever questions you have, I know he'll do his best. 333-9455, that's for Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Our next caller is in Chicago, line 3. Hello.
Thank you. That last call reminded me of how much steam we could get out of a question. Actually, I want to make a humorous comment about the voice of that lady they called. It reminded me a bit of the voice and pitch of Frances Langford when she was on a recording with Don Ameche and the Bickersons. She had that same type of caliber of timbre and a fast repartee between you and Hank Spies going back and forth on the question of the water heater. I was almost laughing because it's such a humorous reminder of that comedy show. But there was an overflow that leads to my question. The building here just installed new inner parts to the water tank of the toilet mm-hmm. tank, and the water is overflowing, and I have to lift the lid and lift that floating ball to get the water to cut off.
Mm-hmm.
Is that all that's really necessary to make some adjustment on that?
Yes.
Just sort of tighten it up?
Well, it depends on what kind you have. But
it's got an arm attached to the water.
Okay, well, generally speaking, you kink the arm so the float goes down further, so it will turn off quicker.
I figured something like that. But it was glad to hear your show, and that humorous call was very refreshing. Bye-bye.
All right, we'll go on here to line number 1 back here in Urbana. That's right here. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a question about mildew prevention and cleanup in a home that has a damp crawl space. I guess I just wanted to know what kind of information Mr. Spies has about that.
Well, okay, first we have to dry out the crawl space.
And how do you do that?
Well, okay. Is the entire soil surface in the crawl space covered with plastic?
As I understand, the crawl space actually has a concrete floor. So I don't know if you call it a crawl space.
Well, okay, it could be a crawl space. Basically, I'm trying to figure out where the moisture is coming from.
Right.
Generally speaking, it may be soaking through the foundation walls, this type of thing. If it is indeed concrete, you'd almost have to go down there and find out where the heck, what's wet down there. Usually damp crawl spaces are the result of improper grading around the outside of the house. We almost never in Champaign-Urbana have water coming up from the ground below. It's nearly always the water from your own roof that is causing the problem.
Okay.
Therefore, we need a set of gutters with extensions discharging the water away from the house, and we need the soil sloping away from the house. And not just in general, but most particularly the 2 feet closest to the foundation. And we oftentimes run into this situation where the soil has settled after the house was built, and nobody has come in and refilled it, so we end up with a little moat around our castle. And this fills with water and gives us dampness problems in the crawl space. So the basic thing is getting that dampness out. Now, what do you do when you have it? You get it off, you wash it off with a solution of about one part of household chlorine bleach to a quart of water, a cup to a quart of water. And that will kill it off. And as long as it stays dry, it will not recur. Because mildew requires moisture, and it requires temperatures between 40 and 100 degrees. So anything colder than 40 won't mildew. Anything hotter probably won't either. But that is the general range in which mildew grows, and we must have very high humidity.
Could you tell me that? What temperature should you keep the home?
Well, the surface needs to be between 40 and 100 to grow mildew. So, generally speaking, the way we keep our home is right in the range where it will grow well. So that means that really the only answer is we've got to control the moisture. Do you have a power humidifier in your furnace?
I don't know. And to tell you the truth, this home is actually in, that I'm talking about, is in Massachusetts, and it is close to the water, and I'm not sure that there isn't some water coming up from the surface, from the bottom.
That could be. Because basically, if there is moisture in the crawl space, you are going to have a mildew problem everywhere, including in the roof.
Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. We have about 10 minutes left here. We have some other callers here. Just want to remind folks, we'll try to get in as many callers as we can in the time that remains. If you want to talk with our guest, Hank Spies, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. We will continue. Next caller is in Champaign on line number two. Hello.
Hi. I had a question about both a product recommendation. I want to make sure I'm headed in the right direction. I had two beams in my basement that sunk in the middle, and I jacked them back up, and I'm replacing the wooden posts that used to hold them up with steel posts.
Mm-hmm.
And those steel posts need to rest on concrete footings that are not level. And so I'm led to believe that I can use a high-strength grout underneath that bottom of the steel post to level it and support it. Is that accurate?
I would think so. Generally speaking, the concrete is already there, I take it.
Yes.
The concrete footing is already there.
Yeah.
I would use high-strength grout or perhaps some steel plate.
I see, to shim it up and level it once I put it in. And if I were to use that grout, what is that something that's available at a concrete supply shop?
I would think so, yes.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. And next we go to Urbana, line number three. Hello.
Yes, I'm concerned about roof gutters.
Mm-hmm.
Are you hearing me?
Yes.
And wondering, are the systems for keeping leaves from clogging upper-level roof gutters efficient?
Most of them are.
So the leaves actually flow across the...
That's correct. The ones that seem to work best, the entire top of the gutter is covered with a metal shield,
mm-hmm.
and it curls in at the outer end, and it's made like a bad pitcher spout, such that the water flowing over it comes back and goes actually flows into the front of the gutter rather than the back.
I see. Okay.
And then the twigs and leaves and so on go on over the edge.
Mm-hmm.
There's probably at least a half dozen of these things on the market from various manufacturers. Prices vary by a factor of two or three, particularly installed prices. There are some that are available. if you want to do it yourself. I don't know that I have ever found one of those that I liked in any of the local big box stores, but there are sources for them.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to do it yourself.
I see.
I worry about people doing it themselves if they don't have proper ladders and are not properly equipped to work at that level.
Yeah, yeah. But I think that's why I need to get these, because I shouldn't any longer mount my roof, I think. All right, well, I just was anxious to hear if these were really efficient.
Yes, generally speaking, they are. And again, if you want to call my office and leave an address, I'll send you a list of ones that are available.
All right, thank you.
All right, thank you. Over to Indiana for our next caller here, line number 4. Hello.
Yeah, I hope I can get a simple answer here. You once told me about a tool that is used to take out tongue and groove flooring without injuring the flooring. Do you know the name of that thing?
Well, there's going to be some injury to the floor regardless. I'm not sure. I mean, basically, yes, there are several tools that work, but you're going to break up one board getting in.
Right, but after that, it should be okay, you said.
Yes, yes.
Okay, what's the name of that tool?
Well, I don't know that I've ever seen a name on the thing. Generally speaking, it looks like a heavy-duty fork that the two tines are far enough apart so that they go on each side of the floor joist and rest on, so you can slip that under and then pull back on it just like a crowbar, and it will lift it out.
Okay. Well, that was one question that occurred to me, because when you described this another time, I called the hardware and they had no idea. Here's my question, and maybe I'll call you back in a few months about it. We've got an old house, and been advised to tear off the back section. Somebody said, well, just take a backhoe to it or a front-end loader and rip it out. But the problem there is that the roofing from the second section is hooked on to the roofing from the back section. So my question is, to begin, should I just take off all the siding and then, using a chainsaw, go down from top to bottom alongside the studs, so that what I'm left with is the studs and the roof?
That sounds like the way to attack it to me.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Good luck.
I don't know what I'll call you back. It'll be a while.
Okay. All right.
Thanks, Hank.
All right. Thanks for the call. Let's go to line number 1, and this is Champagne. Hello.
Good morning.
Yeah.
I have a question about a bow window that was installed, say, about 10 years ago or so, and there's a moisture problem with condensation on the inside, and I looked at it, and all they did, there's an overhang on the roof, but where it sticks out away from the siding, it's not very far, but they just stuck some rigid insulation in there, and that's all that's there. And I was wondering, is there cold air coming in and somehow?
That could be, but let's talk about where exactly is this condensation on the glass?
It's on the glass on the inside, you know.
Yeah.
And
this is sealed double glass. So you have
sealed double glass, yeah.
Well, basically, your problem is you're maintaining too high humidity in the house.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay, that's the deal. Well, it's got a half basement in it, and half of the half basement is a dirt floor.
Get a sheet of plastic down there, 4 mils, 6 mil polyethylene over that dirt, and that will do wonders for you.
That's the deal. Okay. All right. It's that, and it's not the way that was.
That's correct. If you've got condensation on double glass, the humidity in the house is too high.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Let's go to line number 2, and that would be Bloomington, Illinois, right here. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Hank, I am remodeling a kitchen, and I have removed linoleum that it was put on the floor, several coats of linoleum, and the subfloor that is currently down is plywood.
Mm-hmm.
And I was considering or toying with the idea of actually painting a design on the kitchen floor, and I had questions concerning what type of paint I could use, and also what type of sealant can I do once I have the finished product? And is this feasible, or should I just look at commercial tile?
I would look at commercial tile. I think painted plywood is going to be a disappointment for you.
Okay. Good enough.
All right.
Thank you, sir.
All right. Thank you. And to next, Urbana Line 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, hello.
I have a question about refinishing hardwood floor and basically whether it's economically worth refinishing or just a lot of expense and getting a new one would be a better deal.
Well, a lot depends on the shape that the floor is in now and exactly what do you mean by refinishing. Remember that a hardwood floor can be sanded only twice in its lifetime. Basically because it is tongue and groove, and if you sand it enough that the top part of the groove gets too thin, it will split off and you will have all kinds of problems. So, but there is no real reason why you can't, if the basic wood floor is in good condition, I see no reason why you can't refinish either if it hasn't been sanded before. It can be sanded. Please don't do it yourself. A commercial floor sander can, in the hands of an amateur, can cause more damage in 10 seconds than you can fix in a half a day. These things are very aggressive. So basically, you can do that. You may be able to get by with a light sanding and a refinish without the taking off 100% of the existing finish, depending on what the finish is in. So I would think that you've got a real good chance at doing a decent refinish job, and it's probably going to be less than half what would laying a new floor would be.
Okay. Well, we're going to have to stop. My apologies. We have a couple of people that we can't take, but we simply don't have enough time. Next month, though, Hank will be back, and we'll do it all again then. He's here once a month. It's always on a Monday to talk about home repair. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Hank Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service.